Welcome to Railway Legends, Myths, and Stories. This is Kuma, and I talk about trains. Well, what I'm going to talk about today is who owns the train. Well, not really the train, but the individual wagons, cars, and rolling stock that might make up the train. Okay, let's take everything way back. That's way back. That means back to the early years of the 19th century. And for the moment, I'm going to talk about a railroad like the Stockton and Darlington. This is in the British Isles. Now, it wasn't a very long railroad, and it had many times the cars were pulled by horses. And later, they had steam engines, which has made them very famous because they're one of the first to operate with steam engines. A steam engine. But here's the key point. That was one track that went from here to here, and the Stockton and Darlington owned every single hopper wagon, flat car, goods wagon, whatever. They owned it all. Everything there, the locomotive, the tracks, the things at each end. The only thing they didn't really own was whatever they were carrying, including people. Of course, they shouldn't have owned people, but that's the point. They did not own what the cars were carrying. Well, for a long time, this was no big deal. The Stockton Darlington, or for example, the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad in the eastern United States was a very similar early railroad that had just a handful of cars and a handful of locomotives to move them back and forth. Well, what we're talking about was many, many years later, when these early railroads got longer and actually reached the next railroad, and the railroads started hooking together at the ends. Now, we already talked once about gauge, and that's another issue, and we'll talk about that again, because if the track gauge wasn't the same, the rolling stock couldn't move from one railroad to another. Now, oddly enough, some companies thought it was a wonderful thing to stop the car, unload everything into another car, and have it go on. There was one reason for this. They never lost track of that car. They didn't worry so much about the slate, the coal, the fish, the people, whatever, in the car. They were worried about the car. And once they delivered their goods, it's out of my hands. But it was very slow to stop and unload the car from Railroad A when it reached the end of its tracks in Railroad B. Well, a couple of the railroads said, okay, here's what we'll do. I get to the end of my railroad. I'll leave these 4, 5, 10 cars of stuff, and Railroad B, whatever that Railroad B was, would then hook up a train and take it to the other end of their line, and then hand the stuff off to Railroad C, who might then deliver it. So it might cross one or two or more railroads. Okay, fine. The problem was that rail car, that hopper car, that goods wagon belonged to Railroad A. It belonged to the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad. I mean, they paid for it. They might have even constructed it. Okay, they wanted it back. So they would send somebody over. And I do mean send somebody over because we're talking about 1838. There was no internet. There were no cell phones. There were no telephones. There weren't even really any telegraphs at this point, not properly speaking. So somebody, you know, took the train over or got on a horse and rode over and said, hey, Railroad B, where's my car? And they said, oh, they're right over there. Okay, I'll send a locomotive over and get them. Okay, fine. They got them back. This became a bigger and bigger problem, especially as you said, well, are those your cars or are those my cars? Well, at first, there was a simple solution, a very simple. The Stockton and Darlington, the Baltimore and Ohio, the whatever, the, you know, Lewisham and Backwater Railway would paint on the side of their cars, Stockton and Darlington, Baltimore and Ohio, Pennsylvania, whatever the railroad was, they would paint their name on the side of the car, and then people, oh, that's my car. Well, that worked for a little while, and never really went away because it was, well, a bit of advertisement. Okay, so what are we talking about next? Well, I am mostly going to speak about North America and the United States because I know about that the most, although the same problem plagued the British Isles because they had dozens of railroads for many time, well, hundreds at one point. And, of course, all across the Europe, this was true. Well, at least across Western Europe. So what we're going to talk about is my car, my little popper car that was filled with slate got moved over here. Or in the case of the Baltimore and Ohio, maybe it was filled with coal. Okay, and it went over here. And I want that car back. Well, that railroad, the other railroad, we'll call that the money grubber in Eastern. They're the money grubber railroad. And they're very smart. They said, hey, we got the Baltimore and Ohio's car. Let's use it for the next few days, shipping stuff back and forth and not wear out our cars. We'll wear out Baltimore and Ohio's. And in a week, the guy from Baltimore says, where's my car? And they say, oh, it's right there. And they, for a whole week, it's gone back and forth and back and forth. And it's sort of worn out. Or maybe not that much for just a week, but it's worn. And this happens again and again, and the Baltimore says, hey, money grubber, what are you doing? My car's come back from you, and they're all messed. I said, oh, I don't know, what just happened. Well, this became, a real major problem, because railroads tended to use anybody's cars but their own, because everybody else was doing the same thing. Now, I'll jump way up ahead, much later on. The railroads, at least in America initially, signed an agreement, a very hard agreement, that they would move their cars on other railways. Yeah, that'd be okay. But if they needed maintenance, a new brake shoe, new bearings, a fixed brake kit linkage, a wheel, or, the brake wheel, or even the railway wheels, they would fix it. Now, initially, they would send the bill to the Baltimore and Ohio or whatever other railroad that it owned it. But that became complicated after a while, and they finally said, okay, what we're going to do is we're just going to keep a running sort of total that we've done X amount and you do X amount, and if we all come out doing about the same amount of work, we'll all call it even. Well, that sort of worked, but it really worked much later on in the early 20th century because, the federal government, and it's one of the times when they actually did a good job, and the Federal Railroad Authority would go around and fine a railroad if their brakes weren't good, if their wheels were cracked, if something was wrong with the car. And that fine was more than what it would have cost to fix the car. So it was very important to keep the cars in good repair, well, at least enough to fool the railway inspectors, or they could get fined. And it didn't matter whose car it was. At that point, it was on your road, you're responsible. Well, that worked. That worked. That actually sort of got things working. But I want to come back to how we keep track of the cars, because if I'm a railroad and I have 10 cars over here, it's not very hard. That one needs fixing or that one doesn't. I can see all 10 of them. They're sitting right there in the little yard or on this track. I can walk past them in a few minutes. But when you end up with hundreds of wagons or cars for a railroad, we need to do something. Well, the railroads, of course, started doing things like numbering them. This is number one, this is number two. Or sometimes they would do, interesting things like B1 for boxcar number one and H1 for hopper car number one, or some other type of designating system that they might use. Okay, fine. That helped the individual railroad keep things going. But, as I say, it got more and more complicated. So eventually, all the railroads had to get together and come up with a numbering and labeling system that had some consistency of some sort that they would all understand. That they would, so that if the car from, the New York and Harlem Railway, it suddenly ends up over in Chicago, which is a kind of a far away, but it happened. I would know, A, whose it was, and B, I could actually ask them to find out how often was these brakes being replaced and say, you know, this really is a dog of a car, or this is something else. So anyway, that was the whole thing. They wanted to not just keep track of it because of the cost, but, well, other costs of operation. They wanted to know those. So it was very important to try to keep track of these. And by the way, this was all done on paper, pencil, pen, ledgers. That's why there was a lot of clerks. I mean, any business of any size, of any type in the 19th and early 20th century had clerks. Clerks kept track of all this. Hey, they didn't have a computer. That came along, but we're not anywhere near that yet. And I'll come back and talk about that sometime because the railroads embraced computers a lot earlier than a lot of people think. So we'll come back to that another day. All right, now one of the other things is how do you mark the cars that this car belongs to whoever? Well, as I said before, you might paint Baltimore, Ohio in big letters. But that was somewhat inconvenient. It was somewhat inconvenient. So what they came up with was a rail recording mark. It was a simple little multi-letter system, two or four letters that you could read. And if you go look at any railway car in North America, and I do mean North America, Mexico, all of Canada, they use the same system. You will look. And on the car will be these little four letters, usually at one end or the other, usually at both ends, matter of fact, on the side. And you will see letters. Now, in some cases, it's only two letters, like UP, a big letter U and a P, which stands for the Union Pacific Railroad. Now, the Union Pacific then has a set of numbers next to it telling you which car it is. Well, the funny thing, there's only so many digits they use, and they ran out of digits, so they end up with UPL, UPR, UP, what? They have to add an extra letter to their main letter to have enough more numbers to make the system work. Now, some of these designations are very simple to decode. UP, CP for Canadian Pacific. There was the very famous one, the ATSF. Now, it's very funny. This goes way back into the 19th century that their company designation was ATSF for Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe. Okay, SF, Santa Fe. And you might say, oh, better most of the people tried to get short ones, but most of them ended up being three or four letters because, frankly, they ran out of them. Now, there are designations in these letter sequences that tell you other things. And we'll get to that in just a moment. But I want to give you a couple more. I was looking up some railway reporting marks, and I came up with one. HAL. Well, that was for the Hilton on Albany Railroad. What? Yeah. Now, you can also have something like the HTPX. Well, what's HTPX? Well, that stands for the H, period, Thyssen Pickle Company. Yeah, they have a railroad reporting mark. They have some cars. There are small line railroads all over the country. In few cases, there are private owners. Those usually have the letter X in the designation for a private car. Now, a private car does not necessarily mean a luxurious passenger car with a cook and a car attendant and opulence inside. It does. But it also can be a tank car. It can be a box car. I mean, a very famous one is THX. You might see these letters, THX, on a whole bunch of cars. That's a company. It's a company that owns railway cars. It doesn't have a single... Well, if it has any track, it's in one place in one warehouse somewhere where they designate it, and they might not even have that. They simply own cars. And they work out a billing and exchange process with the big roads, the Union Pacific, the ATSF, which isn't there anymore. There's now the Burlington Northern Santa Fe, the BNSF, is the new company's name. Anyway, you would make contracts with them or the Canadian Pacific, and when their cars roll on their rails, they get paid, charged a certain amount. The company makes money by delivering goods. The railroads, you know, move them. But the car owner gets paid for having a car and keeping track of it. And in some cases, these private car owners may have fleets of thousands and thousands of cars. I ran into somebody once who had a fleet of a couple of hundred tank cars. They personally owned several hundred tank cars, and that was the business they were in. They had a little office. They kept track of where all their cars were and who was using them and who was paying them to get to use them. So there's money in railroading, even if you don't have any railroad track, just the cars and things sitting on them. Well, let's go and take a quick look at a few more reporting marks just for the fun of it. Now, this one is good. U.S. Now, this is an old designation, believe it or not. USNZ. This was for the United States Navy. Interesting. The Navy had a Z. Then there was the USOX, which was for the Army. And I've actually seen some of their stuff. Now, mostly in rail museums, but I've seen that. Now, today, I don't know about today, they keep screwing things up in Washington, but today, there's a whole line of cars that start with DOD for Department of Defense. And there'd be DOD with no other designation, then DODA for Army, DODF for Air Force, DODM for Marines, DODN for the Navy, DODU, a spare, and DODX, which applies to all of them, in a sense. Now, I've seen lots of DODX cars. It's funny, there's that X again, just like the HTPX. In a sense, it's a private car owned by the government. I know that sounds ridiculous, silly, and weird, and it is. Okay, it is. But that's beside the point. That's how they do things. Now, I will read this out in case you ever want to, and I might try to remember to put it somewhere. But if you go to http://www.pwrr.org, that site, and I believe if you go to /rrm/, this is where you get reporting marks. You can look up any reporting mark. If you see some very strange letter, you know, slop or something, go look it up on that site, and it will tell you whose car that belongs to, or at least what corporate name it is. So if you ever want to, you know, that's a thing to go look at. Now, they have, I believe that site has, but there are over 13,000 reporting marks and abbreviations for North American railroads. That's just North America. Now, there are probably more cars than that, because as I said, each reporting mark then has, you know, at the moment, I can't remember, it's four or five digit number next to, I think it's four, but in a sense, what that car is. So there's a limitation of how many tens of thousands of cars a single reporting mark, because you have to have another reporting mark to have more numbers. Yeah. Okay, fine. Now, the reporting marks that are listed there are all of them, including ones, well, that haven't been around for a while. I mean, or aren't there anymore. As I say, ATSF doesn't exist anymore, technically. They retain it because it's simple for paperwork. But the company is now the BNSF. Okay, fine. But this is simply a method of keeping track of whose car belongs to who and what. But that doesn't mean the railroad still doesn't paint on the side of the car whatever it is. Whether it's big letter CP for Canadian Pacific, a big UP for Union Pacific, or extremely large letters marked THXX or THX, which is a leasing company, as I say, for rail cars. I've another famous one is Gattex, G-A-T-X, big letter G-A-T-X, and it's painted huge on the side of a tank car. But if you look down in little letters down at the side of the car near the end, there'll still be the little Gattex, because that's a leasing company. They own the cars and they lease them out to whoever needs to transport stuff. Now, you might ask, what? The thing is, except for a few extreme specialty cars, and there are more specialty cars than the railroads would like, Kuma wants a specialty car. A specialty car is one that carries one load. It's really designed to carry one thing. There's a railway car called an auto rack. Now, auto racks are got to be the single most confusing railway car on the railroad. I'm not kidding. It's a very long car. It's very low. It has extra small wheels so it can be lower down. This is so it can carry taller loads. And it looks something like a passenger car. It's, you know, it's all flat on the side with little holes and things in it. But what it carries is automobiles. An auto rack carries automobiles. Well, here's the part that's really funny. An auto rack belongs to two companies. What? Two companies. The bottom, the flat part, the car with the wheels and the brakes and all that, they belong to one company. I've seen one that belonged to Union Pacific. But the frame, the box, the thing above it that protects the cars, might belong to a different company. And I have seen where it says Union Pacific on this, the frame above, and you look down and it says THXX or something. It belongs to a leasing company. So again, that one's tricky because if it comes in, you have to bill one company if you're fixing the wheels and another company if you're fixing doors. Just more and more paperwork, if you want to count. Now, the more specialty a car is, the less likely it is to leave the railroad's control. Now, another specialty car are ones that carry extremely heavy loads. Now, those often belong again to leasing companies, but they're very long, they're very heavy-duty cars, often with not four axles, i.e. 4 times 4, 16 wheels, but 12 or even 16 wheels. In other words, 1, 2, 3, 4 plus 4 more, or 8 axles. You know, we're talking lots of axles because they're carrying extremely heavy loads. And again, those are tricky cars in this whole bit because being so unique, only certain repair shops are really set up to repair them. So they may have to get partial repairs in one shop, be sent back to the railroad that owns it to be finished being repaired. That complicates things. And then there are, now I think it was the Burlington Northern Santa Fe, but I'm not sure. I'll simply tell you, I was on a trip through Washington, and we came across where they had a little problem with the railroad. They had a slide, and the tracks were out of service. Well, they couldn't not run the train. So what they were doing, and I'll tell you, this is really hilariously funny. The car would stop. They would transfer the load from the railway car to a road vehicle, to, you know, being pulled by a tractor. Except in this case, it was being pulled by two tractors because it was the entire body of a 737 airliner was sitting on a set of railway cars. Not one, but a set. Specially built to hook here, and they had to be moved to these, with big cranes, to these road haulers. They would run down the interstate a certain distance, and by the way, they would close it while they did it, then go off onto another place and put it back on a rail car. They were really unhappy about that that rail line being out of service. I can tell you, they were unhappy. But it was neat for me to be able to stop and take pictures of it. Never got that many good pictures, but someday I might put those up. But of course, as I say, those are highly special cars, and they almost never leave your own track. And if they do, well, you really want to get those back, because they are, they're very fancy. So anyway, I think I've gone over why, well, that cars belong to different people, or different companies, as it were, or people. I do remember this one person was a company, but he owned it. So you do have that. Now, all of these marks in North America are the Association of American Railroads. Now, that's okay, because it's not just the United States. It also covers rail cars from Mexico and Canada, sometimes called the Americas. So, sort of U.S.-centric, but at least it's another piece. Now, the one thing I want to say is if you see the letter at the end, like I say, at the end of the last letter is X, that means it's probably a private car owner. In other words, it's somebody who owns a car but doesn't have anything to do with a railroad. And if I had money, anybody wants to send me $500,000 for no particularly good reason, I very well might buy me a private rail car. Now, I'd probably need another $500,000 if you want to send it to me so I can make a parking place for it out front. There's room, and I could probably lease some track from the Union Pacific. But that would be a private car. That'd be a very private car. And I would enjoy that. I don't think there's anybody out there who's either that rich or that silly, but it never hurts to ask. I did find that out from my mother once. It never hurts to ask. They can always say no. And I don't mind you saying, come on, I'm not sending you $500,000. Maybe a cookie or maybe a fish, but not that much money. Okay, that's understandable. Anyhow, I've gone on and on about that. And I hope sometime in the future to go into some of the other aspects of the railway cars. Not just who owns them, but special stuff about them. So, if you tune in again to some future episode of Railway Legends, Myths, and Stories, I will try to explain it, any of the other aspects of how railways work, railways and railroads work. So, anyway, that's all for now. Goodbye. And as always, we hope we see you on the train.